Welcome to the Co-ops and Campuses podcast series, which is being recorded on the unceded and ancestral territory of the Musqueam people. It doesn't take much to realize things aren't going too well for the planet these days. What is clear is that climate change and growing inequity is not going to be fixed by more disaster capitalism. In this series, we're going to learn from students, staff, faculty, and activists who are actively responding to the crisis we face through building cooperatives on campuses, and in some cases, in building an actual cooperative university. I'm Michelle Stack, and I'll be your host. My guest today is Bill Engleton. He is the author of two books and also has a blog and writes poetry. He's a retired social worker, he was a journeyman, a government protection social worker, and a union activist. Bill chairs the Hornby and Denman Island Community Care Society. I was delighted when Bill got in touch with me to tell me about the Campus Residents Cooperative Association at Simon Fraser University, which has been going strong since 1967. Bill was an early member, and he's still involved. Bill, welcome.
Hello. Hello, Michelle.
Bill, the first question I have for you is, how did you get involved in the CRCA?
I ran the elections for the first student government of Simon Fraser. I got elected to the student council, and it was very evident early on that there was no housing available for students. The only built housing when Simon Fraser started was the Madge Hogarth girls' residence, women's residence, I suppose. There were plans for other things to happen, but there wasn't anything available. And so some grad students and a few other people started arguing for the building of co-op housing. There was some federal funds. With the help of council, they brought out Howard Edelman, who was involved in a number of things in terms of co-op housing, student housing in Ontario, including Rochdale, which wasn't necessarily student housing, but was a massive enterprise that started somewhat later. He came out here and it spurred things on very quickly. A group of people were offered a house to rent in New Westminster. And they lived there while they gathered the funds from CMHC and a defunct UBC, essentially a defunct UBC housing co-op, a male, sort of like a fraternity, but a co-op. So they bought these two Georgian houses. They were two of three in the block, renovated them. And they were already boarding houses. So they had a lot of built-in separate suites. That didn't take very long. Within about 5 months from when they started, they essentially moved in the summer of 67. That's when I moved in September. So they were there for a couple of months before I moved in.
And so was it the lack of housing, do you think, that created the interest in the CRCA?
That was part of it. It was also just, you know, it was a very creative time in terms of how people related to each other. Simon Fraser was a wonderful place in terms of learning, because a lot of people had come from Berkeley and elsewhere. The whole hippie movement and a range of political views, you know, mostly progressive. So there was all of that and just wanting to experiment with lifestyles. And that was one lifestyle that they thought would work in terms of providing housing, a certain amount of housing for students, as well as having some control over your living environment. Because they basically, we owned it once we got the money from CMHC. We had a mortgage, and most people at the time involved did not have much experience with mortgages, I have to say. And it was dicey. It was a little dicey from time to time.
Can you talk a bit about that? Because that's something that comes up when I talk with people about housing co-ops. How are students going to handle a mortgage?
We were actually fairly fortunate, and I'm not sure how the initial connection was made, but the Westminster Credit Union had a very progressive manager, and probably was the lifestyle sort of maybe appealed to him. I don't know. He was a very generous fellow, but I'm sure he facilitated the mortgage along with CMHC's help in terms of how the monies were funneled. Our job was to make sure we had enough money to pay, you know, and so people who lived there, it was a room and board arrangement, essentially. I think the first amount was $80 a month for room and board, but it was fairly cheap. Ideally, the people living there were supposed to be affiliated with Simon Fraser. That occasionally got circumvented, depending on, well, one of the horrors of collective living is that very early on, the original founders, within 6 months, they had had enough of the experiment and moved on to other communal living situations, a little less structured. And so the first couple of years were a question of building and rebuilding your grassroots membership.
What were the challenges in those early years?
Well, food was one. I mean, there were a few people who knew how to cook. I have to say, mostly it was women. So you had a lot of men who didn't know how to cook. I was certainly one of them. I had to learn. And of course, you're experimenting and your victims are the people you're trying to feed. We would have anywhere from 20 to 40 people. It would vary, as you know, there were about 20 bedrooms.
Wow.
In the two houses. And I say that because at some point we eliminated one kitchen in one house and made it a bedroom. And there were other rooms that were like, there was an experiment where there were four of us in one bedroom for a period of time. So there was all sorts of creative living arrangements suggested, depending on personal preference. But anyways, the cooking was something that we all had to learn. And then food buying for a large group became a significant issue as well. So I remember specifically going to Kelly Douglas, sort of a warehouse for, I guess, Safeway. We would get boxes of their really old lettuce, et cetera. And so there was all sorts of scrounging and scavenging and, you know, couple that with everybody being a student.
Do you remember any examples of conflicts during that time?
Well, the classic one, I have to admit, because we have two houses, there was a movement afoot to remove bathroom doors that the whole notion of privacy did not seem to fit some people's definition of communal living. And so the house essentially broke into two different forces, those who believed in bathroom doors and those who didn't.
Yikes.
From my perspective, I have to say the conservative side that I represented, the ones who preferred to have bathroom doors that closed and that in fact existed, won. But it was touch and go for a while.
I think I'd be on your side on that one. So how did it get resolved? Do you remember?
At some point, people, they just respected that maybe we didn't need to do that, you know, and if somebody didn't want to have they could leave their door open if they were in the bathroom. So, I mean, it wasn't a complex problem, but it was a point of contention.
Mm-hmm.
We had a decision-making process that, for the most part, and I don't know if they still have it here, but we would have Sunday night meetings, and we would have a swing around where everybody had to voice their opinion, sort of like a talking stick passing around. So we had a fairly democratic process by which we made decisions.
And so the co-op still exists today?
Yep.
Why do you think it's continued for so long?
Well, I think initially, it almost went under initially because it had one dominant political force. You know, there was very strong political people, Trotskyists for one. And, I mean, just like fairly serious people who had a whole worldview. And what evolved the first 2 to 3 years is that it became a community where there wasn't one predominant view. And so there was that kind of, it wasn't a cult in that sense. It had no one orientation other than living collectively and trying to get along and making collective decisions. So I think that's probably what made it work, is that it was not dominated by any one political view. I think that may still, to some degree, be true. You know, it's just people recognize that the greater good was communal living and sharing resources.
That's really interesting. You mentioned the word cult, and that's something that comes up sometimes, that people see co-ops like a cult.
Yeah.
How would you respond to that from your own experience?
Well, in fact, it wasn't. I mean, there were all sorts of attempts over the years to have, you know, sort of, there are very self-improvement cults that have come along. And so people get drawn into them.
Mm-hmm.
There were always, I have to admit, I was always one of those people who was never drawn into any of that. So just having people who were able to resist that, because we did have people who fell into the arms of the comfort of having other people think for you. We generally promoted not having that as being the best way And it's just independent thought. I mean, we were a student co-op for the most part. We believed in some of the benefits of just free thinking and having an open mind. And I think that permeated the organization. And we had people, for the most part, who subscribed to that.
It's interesting. Economic crisis or during times of social unrest seem to be a time that co-ops really get started.
I think so. I think we had a huge diversity of people. We had some very smart people from across the country and from the States. We just had a nice balance of people. And I mean, we did have a process to select new members. I mean, we were always, you know, we always needed to find somebody new because somebody was always moving out. But we tried to be as democratic as we could. One time, there was a mother and two children who were there. And the mother did have some issues. It was problematic. Anyway, so we ended up voting in the children and not the mother. And being a brilliant mother, she said, okay, my children can stay. They were of an age where they could almost be on their own. And she lived down the street for a while. So it was an odd situation. I have to say, as a social worker, it was very peculiar. I wasn't a social worker at that point. Basically said, yeah, we'll go along with that. I mean, that's where a democratic process lies. And I'm not sure this was the early 70s. So it was we were still kind of influenced by some of the thinking about raising children. Yeah. You know, that it takes a village and we had other children as well. So and these young men were somewhat older. They were in their early teens and early to mid teens. They fit in pretty, really well and it worked for them. And I don't know that we could have planned it that way. It just worked for them.
So the mother was not accepted?
A strong personality, perhaps too grating. I mean, when you're living collectively, I mean, you can accept a range of personalities, but at the same time, you need to have some barriers, some limitations. At least that's how we found it. And, you know, so there were just some people, not many, who didn't quite, just couldn't mesh, you know, that we couldn't, it just wouldn't work because it's quite an intimate experience living with even 20 or 30 people because you're sharing cooking responsibilities. Like, you know, you had to be on a team once a week. And so you only had to cook once a week or clean up. So you just needed to have people who were able to be in accord with each other sufficiently to get along. And not everybody is fully attuned to that.
Interesting.
And could not learn how that would work. I'm probably hedging my answer.
No, that's fine. One of the critiques of co-ops, well, like any institution, is that they tend to reproduce themselves, that members choose people that they see as similar to themselves. Do you think this is a valid criticism? Was it something that you saw in your involvement in the CRCA or in other co-ops?
Not particularly. I mean, I think we had a range of ethnic backgrounds. And speaking of how we chose, at one point, I think around the time that I moved in or shortly thereafter, the I Ching was used to select whether somebody was suitable or not. So, I mean, it varied. We had a selection process kept on changing, but it was really just that kind of personal connection of, you know, will you fit into our community? So I suppose there was I think we were flexible enough. I mean, it was just a much more flexible time in some respects, you know. Right. So a lot more was tolerated. I mean, at least I think it, you know, was more tolerated than perhaps later on.
Are you still involved in the co-op?
Only from a distance. We had our 50th anniversary in 2017, and I was part of the committee, even though I was away. But I still have many of my social network. You know, over the years have been the people who lived there. It was strong relationships.
So some of your friends today are people you met from the 60s and 70s. That's impressive. Just what is it about those relationships that there was such a bond?
Yeah, shared experiences. For some of them, I mean, when I eventually moved out, I didn't particularly want to, but it was a decision my wife and I made after a long number of years. And I probably would have stayed there. I had plans to stay there till I was a very old person. We had, in fact, had people who retired there. I have one story about that that might be of interest, but not many, but that one story. But so my plan was to stay there and retire there. And I just loved the collective experience, but it was time to move on. But I still later on with people there bought property together, like recreational property. Yeah. So those kinds of connections were formed and levels of trust, I suppose.
I'd love to hear the story about the person that retired and lived in the co-op.
I'll give his name. He's been gone for a very long time. His name was René Lassance, and he he worked for an oil company and something like that. And at some point, he had a niece who from South America who's passed through the co-op, and she told him about it. And he was, 65, 70, and it was time for him to retire. So he didn't speak English. He arrived one day. He had his room ready because we knew he was coming. He lived out for the next 10, 11 years there making wine and sharing it, I have to say, with many of us. And he cooked a wonderful meal that I personally loved, and he loved hockey. So anyways, he never spoke English. You know, there were a few people who spoke French. I was never one of them. But he lived there, retired there, and died there. So I've always wondered if I'm going to end up like him. I mean, it's just a thought. We'll see.
That's really interesting. It really is an intergenerational co-op.
Yeah, no, we had a few other seniors who were there. The niece, I said, of my friend, my friend's mother lived there for a number of years, and she was in her 70s. So, I mean, and so the children who grew up there, and there were a fair number of children, they would come back and sometimes live there as adults, sometimes not. I mean, but a lot of the connections continue amongst the various levels of, in the various generational levels.
So it's not a requirement to be a student member.
Well, that kind of went by the wayside. I mean, lifelong learners, I think most of the people there are lifelong learners. They want to learn new stuff. For the place to continue, it had to be flexible in terms of who was willing to live there, who was appropriate to live there.
I wonder why co-ops are relatively rare on campus, given the success of some of the ones that have existed.
You know, I think getting started is probably the problem. And as I said, we had to rebuild a few times, right? You know, you'd have a swath of people leave, things would go awry, and then you'd rebuild again. So we were really fortunate to survive. But I think just being able to share space, like many of us had our own separate rooms or we shared a room, but there were lots of communal spaces. And on Denman Island, where I live, there are a range of other kinds of shared living and co-housing, for example. We have a co-housing project that's been here for a while. And it requires that kind of constant reinforcing of relationships, you know, and doing things collectively. And maybe that's not the kind of society we've really got as much as we would like to think we have. So those skills need to be sometimes taught. I learned them by living in a co-op, and I may have forgotten some of them since I haven't been living in a co-op, but I think they're very valuable skills. And I see it in living in a small island here, that there's people have learned to work together, you know, much more intimately over the time here, you know, not necessarily living in the same space. So those kinds of working together skills are probably more rural or more cooperative. You know, I mean, the word co-op is pretty descriptive of what you have to do to make it work in terms of interpersonal relationships. And I don't want to put too much of a sheen on it, but I mean, the 60s and the early 70s where there was clearly there was a sexual freedom that kind of got lost maybe over time or got kind of reworked. So those kinds of situations where we were always exploring then, you know, and it was seemed to be the time of our generation's time to explore those things. So that probably helped me in learning some things, you know, in the co-op, we had some fairly strong women, and they curtailed any kind of or most sexist behavior that might come from young men like I was, you know. I mean, they just didn't tolerate it. So I learned early on some things that I think have stood me in good stead professionally and just as a man.
And how did they do that in terms of women in the co-op? Sexism?
No, one time they went on strike. They wouldn't cook anymore. So that they just said, the roles of women are changing. And not that they were doing the cooking, but I mean, mostly we relied on their, almost said traditional skills. I take that back. But what women traditionally had done, perhaps, certainly in my home, I can't imagine my father ever cooking a meal. They just emphasized their own liberation. And I mean, that certainly helped me as I went forward. I was in a career where women were by far in charge of everything. You know, there were some men who thought they were, but it was mostly female social workers doing the work. So I was kind of an anomaly.
And how do you think your experience would have been different going to a university had you not lived in a co-op?
Oh, I would have been a much duller fellow, I think. I can't even begin to figure out how that would be. I felt so fortunate to go to Simon Fraser when it was there, but also to be part of the co-op was just such a liberating experience for me. And it just seemed so natural, too. It just made so much sense in the way that I was thinking about how you had to be collaborative and work in partnership and those kinds of things. I just don't think I would have learned that elsewhere. I might have, but then we all might take those little slight detours that take us to a whole other kind of life. So I'm just thankful that I fell in with the people I fell in with.
So your first experience.
Yeah.
How about how the co-op dealt with issues of social injustice?
We were pretty active politically, just in terms of things. I mean, some of there was a whole big women's movement in Vancouver at the time, and some of the people from the co-op were involved in it. Just very active. There was a march to Ottawa that some of them later went on. It was like 1970. And I know I was involved I was thumbing through some old news clips of like in 1971, we were arguing with the city council to put up a hostel for youth, you know, and that got shot down. But we were trying to make a difference politically. So just as a co-op, we were doing that. And we would take people in who needed housing. So that was the kind of thing we were doing.
What would your advice be to people wanting to start up a campus cooperative or a co-op that serves campuses?
Well, I would like to see some political direction from government or somewhere to make it just available as a concept. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, students are transitory, you know. I mean, they're there for a period of time and then they're gone. And so it's really hard to structure that. We were fortunate that we had a good start and we were large enough that we had a range of people who were willing to be a part of it. But it was those initial people who started it that made it work, even though they didn't stay. And so you need those kinds of creators and you need to find them and you need to, I guess, make it possible for them to get access to funds to do what needs to be done. There was a formal organization. It had certain responsibilities to this, you know, we were a society. So we had to make an annual report. There were things that we had to do. I think that structure helped us survive. And so you need to be able to do that and find the people who are the creators. Finding those people is really hard, you know, particularly at the student level. So our co-op was started by some grad students, you know, who moved on to do other things, but they had some hefty skills they brought with them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's really interesting to see what you're saying about the need for some sort of structure for building that kind of trust that's so important in the success of a co-op.
So I think you need to have the structure and you have to have, you know, I just think it's a heck of a way to live, and it's a good use of space and it's a good use of resources. So it's very environmentally practical these days.
Do you think part of the reason the CRCA succeeded is because it's not just students?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it hasn't limited itself to that. And it's just kind of defined that most people are students. We're just learning how to get along and move along. You know, so a number of the people who would come there were women leaving difficult domestic situations or reinventing themselves. So there's a whole host of people. And I think that kind of broader look at community makes the most sense for seniors housing or for any kind of housing, that you need to have a range of ages and backgrounds.
When I've mentioned intergenerational co-op, so often the response is, well, we couldn't have students and faculty get together, or students and staff. The students are going to be noisy and, you know, the faculty were bookworms. So it's just fascinating in terms of what you're saying. It disrupts the sense that it wouldn't work.
Yeah, and that's what we ended up having. We had professors and, you know, we had a range of people coming through. The current co-op, I don't know if they still have, they have a physician. The representative somewhat of the community. We accommodated a lot of difficult people. Some people would have thought I was a difficult person, and that's probably true to some extent. But, you know, I mean, it was just, there was a tolerance that I think we were large enough that we were able to accommodate. And so size actually might make the difference to some extent.
Bill, thank you so much for your time.
I hope this proves to be useful.
It's been really interesting for me, just thinking about a co-op that's been going for 54 years and that's intergenerational. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And hopefully we'll have another conversation.
Okie doke. Take care.